This B Podcast Network show is presented by IXL. Loved and trusted by more than 1 million teachers, IXL enhances your teaching and takes work off your plate so you can make an even bigger impact on your students. IXL delivers personalized learning across a comprehensive pre-K-12 curriculum, including math, language arts, science, and social studies, and helps you assess student performance through actionable, real-time insights. Strengthen daily instruction, close knowledge gaps quickly, and set every student up for success. Want to bring IXL to your school? Learn more at IXL.com/BE. That's IXL.com/BE. Welcome to the Cyber Traps Podcast. I am Jethro Jones, coming to you from Washington, host of the podcast Transformative Principal, and author of the book School X, How to Redesign Your School for the People Right in Front of You. I am a former principal at all levels of K-12 education. Greetings, everybody. I'm Frederick Lane, an author, attorney, and educational consultant based in Brooklyn, New York. I'm the author of 10 books, including most recently Cyber Traps for Educators 2.0, Raising Cyber Ethical Kids, and Cyber Traps for Expecting Moms and Dads. Jethro and I have teamed up to bring timely, entertaining, and useful information to teachers, parents, and others about the risks arising from the use and misuse of digital devices. Over the coming weeks and months, we'll be talking to some of the world's leading experts from the fields of education, parenting, sociology, cyber safety, and today, mental health. Join us as we look at what it takes to better navigate our increasingly high-tech world. The Cyber Traps Podcast is a production of the Center for Cyber Ethics, an independent, nonpartisan educational institute dedicated to the study and promotion of cyber ethics as a positive social force through research, curricula development, publishing and media, professional training, and public advocacy.
The Cyber Traps Podcast is pleased to announce that Buoyancy Digital is the inaugural mission partner for the Cyber Traps Podcast series. A digital advertising consultancy with an ethos, Buoyancy was founded by Scott Rabinowitz, who has been in digital media since 1997 and has overseen $300 million in youth safety compliant ad buys across all digital platforms. For IAB, Google, and Bing accredited brand and audience safe advertising sales solutions, media buying, and organizational training for media publishers, reach out to Scott Rabinowitz at Scott R. Media on LinkedIn or by visiting buoyancydigital.com. Hey there, Jethro.
Hello, Fred. Good to see you and hear you sound so crisp right now.
Yeah, nothing like a trip to the ironing board between interviews. So there you go. Jethro, it is always good to reinstall your software and make stuff work.
Or use a Mac.
No, this is a nonpartisan operation.
Sure. That's right. Nonpartisan. Sorry about that.
That is quite all right. Well, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce Mike Skinner today as our guest. Mike is a nationally known award-winning advocate, educator, writer, and critically acclaimed singer, songwriter, guitarist, and for the purposes of our show today, a survivor of horrific child abuse. Addressing the issues of trauma, abuse, and mental health concerns through public speaking, writing, and his music. He has spoken at the National Press Club, was a keynote presenter for a conference held by the United Nations, the State Department, and Georgetown University on the sexual exploitation and trafficking of children and adults. And he was part of the groundbreaking Oprah Winfrey shows that addressed the issues of males sexually abused as children. His role as a consultant and trainer for the federal government Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration's National Center for Trauma-Informed Care and the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors has been crucial in helping to shape the policy initiatives and directives for the delivery and implementation of trauma-informed care and services. His music and advocacy website has been visited by well over a million people, and he is the founder and director of The Surviving Spirit, a nonprofit helping those impacted by trauma, abuse, and mental health challenges through the creative arts, advocacy, education, a monthly newsletter, and website. And we will, of course, provide the link to that in the show notes for this podcast. So I would urge people to add themselves to the seven figures who have visited. And Mike, I am just really honored to have your time today and have you contribute to this conversation. Thanks for joining us.
And thank you. I send that back to the two of you for what you are doing. So I'm always honored when folks have me to be a part of what they're doing to help raise awareness on all the matters that are of importance. So thank
you. Well, Mike, if I recall correctly, you and I met through Terry Miller, who founded the Stop Educator Sexual Abuse, Misconduct, and Exploitation, better known as Sesame. And you can visit that at sesamenet.org. So we've been working on this issue for a while now. It helped inform the work that I did on Cyber Traps for Educators back in 2015, and then the update that just came out last year. Obviously, I think it's worth pointing out to our audience that the events that helped lead you to where you are right now happened well before the cyber age, but the issues and the impact it had on you is still relevant, unfortunately, for kids who are going through this today. And so I think, you know, certainly your insights will be very valuable to people both in the educational community and for parents as well.
Thanks. I sometimes try to understand how would I dealt with this back then as a kid when it was hard enough. But now with the whole internet thing and just the whole cyber thing, you know, my kids are all raised adults, but obviously I got to think about grandchildren, what's going on. So what you guys are doing, I mean, that's great because this stuff is out there. It hasn't stopped. Even with all the raising awareness as folks have done in organizations, the exploitation and the hurting of children and adults still goes on to this day. As a child, I did not understand why my parents would do what they were doing to me sexually, physically, emotionally, but also doing so with other adults and why this also took place at a church. Now, I cannot give you all the details. I can't, because that's, you know, how trauma works. You know, there's parts that are crystal clear and there's other parts that are cut off. But I always did remember, you know, the taking of pictures. So now you have what you folks are doing back then. So I sometimes wonder, how did these folks even connect back then, long before the internet? How did they find each other? I was born in 1954. So how did,
Yeah. I mean, that's such a powerful question. And I'll tell you that when I was researching my first book, which is, you know, sadly relevant in some ways to the experience that you went through, it was called Obscene Prophets, about the rise of the online adult industry. And one of the things that I was trying to do in that book was to help people understand the role that technology was playing in changing the landscape. And so when you look back to the 1960s, the 1970s, which is the period relevant for you, you had people who were communicating via the back of really sketchy little magazines that were circulated in tobacco shops and under the counter in different places. You had word of mouth was very powerful. And you had people connecting in basically mailing lists with overseas producers and all the rest of that. But honestly, the real problem was that we began to see over that period of time the development of technologies that allowed people to produce things at home. So those photos were probably Polaroids, or, you know, they would have maybe found a film person, because you could. I mean, there were people who advertised, you know, the development of those kinds of photos, but it was super risky. But again, home movies, Polaroids, all of that made a big impact. So, you know, I'm deeply sorry that we're still talking about this 40 years, 50 years later. You know, hopefully we can get some insight in terms of how parents and other adults should react or should be on the lookout for the kinds of things that happen to you?
I had a fourth grade teacher that I truly believe grasped what was going on, because he'd always ask me questions. Then he asked me, would I stay after school to help him? And at first it was like all excited. Then it was like, uh-oh, what's he want? You know, because my experience with adults, but he was actually a really nice man, a really good teacher. He was a Korean War veteran. My father was a Korean War veteran. So this was like, you know, I'm 9, 10 years old. This man's really nice. But he was asking me questions, lots of questions about my parents. Now, I can't tell you guys specifically what he was asking, but it was always probing. But, you know, you were just, I'll just say you were brainwashed, you know, to stay silent. But there was also the threats of what would happen. That's why when I talk or try to raise awareness on this, there's an impact. I'm stronger now. I'm not afraid of them, but that impact lasts with you a lifetime. So even back then as a child, when given that opportunity, I could not answer that man. A few years later, when I'm 12 and 13, I start skipping school. There was a sergeant on the Billerica, Massachusetts police force. He'd stop and pick me up because he wanted to know about my delinquency. Years later, he was also asking me questions. So there, as much as I rail against those who didn't help or didn't do anything, there were people back then trying to help, but I was still stuck in fear. You come forward today, it's still the same thing. Kids today, teenagers, adults are afraid to speak. I can speak in mental health agencies, peer support agencies for folks dealing with mental health issues, and they'll come up to me after I've performed or shared or both talking, and then they'll pull me aside and say, I went through that. But they're afraid to tell their counselor. They're afraid to tell anyone because there's such a pushback. There is a built-in shame around it. The society pushes on you. There's a silence they expect, and there's this stigma of you can't talk about this. And then the repercussions. I started breaking the family secrets back in 93 and 94. My siblings cut me off. My friends cut me off. Not all, but you know, you're cut off from society. I started raising awareness about the sexual abuse that impacted my life. I'd have mental health agencies who were hiring me to present or talk. Well, could you downplay the abuse part? And you hear me, I'm not getting graphic. I just say to you, I was sexually abused as a child. You can connect the dots, but so these agencies were telling me to be quiet. And that still has not changed to this day, a larger part of society.
So, I mean, that piece there is unfortunate. Part of the issue, I believe, is that one, people don't want to admit that these things are happening because it makes us feel out of control, which is certainly an issue. And as a school principal myself, being able to help kids through this process in a very minimal way, because I'm not a therapist or anything like that, but being that adult who asks questions and tries to identify the signs, it's really distressing to hear that kids don't want to tell what's going on, because we could at least try to help if they did tell us. But by the same token, it's really difficult to actually get help to someone who's being sexually abused or physically abused. And it seems like it is hopeless sometimes for us as outsiders to be able to help. What advice would you give someone who is in that outside position and feels like they can't do anything because, one, there's no proof, and at least that we can tell, we just may have an inkling or a feeling. What advice would you give to someone in that position?
School, start with school, because, you know, most of us are going to school. It should be a place of safety. You know, we can get into the whole bullying aspect. That's another place. So survivors of abuse, they're going to school and they're being traumatized, re-traumatized again from bullies. So that really has to be addressed on all levels. But school should be a safety zone. And you're right. No teacher, no principal, no guidance counselor can really pull you out and save you unless there's proof. But validating and just showing that kid that you care for them as a human being, that fourth grade teacher, now I'll jump forward when I'm, you know, senior and junior in high school, I had a lot of rage. I was in a lot of fights. I was in the principal's office all the time. He also understood something. he'd give me in, you know, in-house suspension or whatever, but he also helped me to graduate. But again, he couldn't take me out of that home, nor could that fourth grade teacher, but they validated me as a human being. They understood as best they could. So I think schools, that it has to be a place of safety. And I would defer to you folks on how you know schools operate and stuff, but pull in a panel of survivors, because I'm not the only one out there. Again, nothing about us without us. Have survivors or parents speak to this. What would make the school a safe place for kids who are being abused and neglected at home?
Well, and I think that that's a really good place to start. And again, it's challenging because we don't want to expose all the other kids to this darkness that exists. But at the same time, we have to address it. And it's a delicate thing to do. And in my schools where we implemented trauma-informed practices, we were at least able to take those kids who were struggling and provide some kind of support so that we weren't sending them back home into an abusive environment by keeping them out of school. And we were having them in school instead. Things like that, that certainly helped, but that is a touchy subject to be sure. And there's potential for backlash from parents about talking about it openly, especially with students, but certainly with having a panel like that with teachers would be very beneficial to let them see that's happening.
But I've also seen when I've gone into schools to speak, whether it's high school or college or university, I'd see these different posters raising awareness on things. That in of itself is huge. So if all schools had that information, and then they'll have a phone number or something. And I do see the ones where it's the anti-bullying campaigns thing. So I just think more of that, more literature out there on the wall, that so you're not having a conversation, but the kid is going to be seeing that. Maybe they'll pick up the phone someday.
To that piece, being able to recognize that bullying can take many different forms, and an adult abusing a child is certainly child abuse, but that is also a form of bullying that you shouldn't discount that from the type of bullying that can exist. Go ahead, Fred.
Well, I just, you know, I wanted to follow up on Mike's point a little bit, because it seems that it gets to this idea of almost a conspiracy of silence with respect to sexual issues in our society, unless it's being used to sell something. And that seems to me to be one of the profound flaws with how we approach this. And I guess, Mike, and maybe this is just an obvious point, but if we could have more open, honest discussions about sexuality in general, that would help, because it would take away some of the shame factor. And then to your point, if Jethro, you can weigh in on this, if we could have some kind of poster that just basically like the suicide hotlines, you know, where there was a static reference to a resource for kids where they could get that support in a trusted environment, it seems like that would make a difference.
There's a series of things. And then I started out as a straight A student. And then I passed high school by the skin of my teeth. But my brother, who followed me a year behind, kept up his grades, goes off into the Air Force. We're experiencing the same thing. But several years later, he's ending his life. So if you were looking at him, the principal said, oh, but his brother is such a model, he's got all the high grades. He's got this, that, and the other. Well, he's the one who's ending his life later on, as did another brother. So there's no easy answer to this, but at least having the conversation. And then, you know, circling back to bullies, you know, I'm older, I'm wiser. A lot of my fights were against the bullies who were picking. And then I just learned to fight back. As I got old, I realized those bullies, they were coming from being bullied. You know, so right there, that should be a red flag. So if the kid in school is going around hurting other people, that is saying something, because that was taught to them. It's being done to them, and they're just reenacting that. So I don't like what they were doing, but I also have empathy that's coming from a place. It's the same thing with those who've committed crimes or in prison. There's all this rage that they never was able to work through. I was able to do it through music and drumming. I boxed for a while and just different things to get that out of my system, but finding different ways so the kids can channel this suppressed rage into a productive way. And again, there's many answers to that, but we're just scratching.
Yeah. Well, and you're bringing up a point that we often forget, especially during the pandemic. Many of those extracurricular activities have been canceled and people aren't doing them. And my argument would be we should be canceling our main courses, math, science, social studies, not because those aren't important, but because what's more important is everybody's mental health and being able to provide outlets for creativity, for rage, for frustration, being able to do the things that bring peace, comfort, and healing to people. And we have essentially kicked all of those to the wayside, which I think is really an unhealthy response, that we should be doing the exact opposite.
I agree. You know, in my heart of hearts, I wish I just could have gone back to being a musician all the time. I was also in the music business, but life happened. The trauma came back to bite me. So I'm still able to perform as a musician, but now I do this advocacy piece. But on that point of music, you know, because there's lots of great speakers out there. I'm not a PhD. I don't have this, that, and the other, but I have this life experience. I have learned a lot about trauma. I've taken a lot of classes, but I'm a musician. I can connect to people. So when I do a presentation, whether it's by, obviously everything now is Zoom, or any live event, whether it's 10, 20, or several hundred, that music was connecting us. I see that the same with friends of mine who are artists, regardless of the type of trauma or abuse that they grew up with. They're reaching people through their arts, their creativity. And that's one of the things that I really stress when I do present is all of us are creative and trauma disconnects us from that creativity. So finding a way to get back to that. So obviously in the schools, as I agree with you, that should not be cut from the schools because that is such an outlet for all for children right up to adults.
I actually, Mike, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this to you, but I spent 10 years on a school board up in Burlington, Vermont. So a little farther north than you. But of course, you know, we were relatively small. I mean, the biggest city in the state, but truly not saying much as far as Vermont goes. And we were always grappling with these budgetary issues. And at the same time, you know, I'm friends with teachers and have teachers in my family. And there needs to be a real caution about mission creep for teachers, right? In the sense that we can't ask them to be everything within our society. And over the years, we have, one way or the other, dumped a lot of tasks on them. It does seem to me, though, that what could be useful is to have educators have at least a basic understanding of these kinds of issues and the things to look for so that they can point these kids in the right direction. This is not to ask teachers to be counselors or social workers, because that is not what they're trained to do. And I will beat that drum day in and day out, even though I am not remotely a musician. But that being said, I just think as a society, we want teachers to be in a better trained position to help kids deal with these issues. Is this something you discuss in your advocacy? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I do. I'm always addressing the piece about music and the arts, whatever form they take, because also trauma is disconnecting us. Music and the arts can connect us. So my example, many years ago, I used to do this little music group at a mental health peer support center, folks struggling with real serious issues, trauma, abuse, and mental health. And again, it could go from 10 to 40 people. And this is the only place that they would go to for a cup of coffee and support, learn about job skills and all the rest of it. A lot of them then started attending the pubs and coffee houses that I was performing at. And I wasn't even thinking about that, right? That connection. And then it was the board and some of the other people said, Michael, do you understand what you're doing? I said, I'm just reaching them as a musician. Michael, they're going out into the general public. And there was one place in particular I did a Sunday night, every Sunday night. And what was nice to see these folks, and you could tell because some of them had the shaking and all the rest of it. But the folks that were in this bar, and it wasn't a biker bar, but they were bikers, you know, but good bikers, some tough people, but they were interacting with those folks, buying them their sodas or fruit juices. They were now getting socially connected through music. Now, I'm not the only one doing it. There's others who are doing it on a grand scheme. Again, a lot of this, Fred, just came about just me being a musician. I'm like, oh, this works. Oh, this works. You know, so I didn't go into this with this grand design. I didn't. It just happened organically. And then the same thing with speaking, at sharing some songs and people saying doing more songs. So I do. Yeah, the creative part piece to this, I think, is so important, and it's also missing.
Yeah, and Fred, addressing your issue that you brought up about teachers being teachers, not counselors or therapists, and the trauma-informed training that I do with teachers, it is 100% you are not counselors. And in fact, that's one of my introductory statements, is that one thing we get wrong in trauma-informed practices in schools is that we try to tell teachers that they are counselors or something that they're not. And their role as teacher is valuable and needed, and they need to stay there. They shouldn't be going out and doing other things. They should be teachers, and we should respect that and keep that solely on their plate and not add other things to it. And this is where, you know, another aspect of it is some kids are not into music, and music does connect us. Some kids are not into art, but art does connect us. But there are a lot of other ways to bring people together and to find that connection through something positive. And I think it's incumbent on us in schools to find those ways to connect kids to something positive, and whatever that may be, to meet their particular needs or interests is a worthwhile endeavor also.
I agree. And I agree with you on, it's not the teacher's role, nor is it police role to do these things. My whole thing with the trauma-informed piece is just for someone to reframe it, thinking, what has happened to this person? What's going on in their life versus what's wrong with this child? What's wrong with this person? Even if they just get to that point, what has happened to them? That can change the whole, the conversation, or just even the mindset, how they're looking at someone.
Mike, just reading through your bio and thinking about some of the things that have taken place recently, one of the topics that I expect to write on at some point in the not too distant future is under a working title, hashtag tech sick masculinity, which is about the impact of technology on men and maleness. And one of the things I think that makes your advocacy particularly powerful is that as much as our society has a challenge talking about sexual trauma and sexual abuse, it has an even worse time talking about it with respect to young boys. And so I'd love to get your comments on how that's played out in the work you've done.
It's still there, Fred. Regardless of where I've been, as you just asked that question, I'm thinking of the, he was ramrod straight. He looked like he's just got out of Marine boot. He was the drill sergeant for the boot camp, but he was a retired police captain. And he come up and he thanked me for what I was doing. He says, but I could never say this. And I've heard this from countless other males. And I've heard, there was a time in my life, I was working with troubled youth boys and stuff. And the few times that they did share, their counselors would tell them, or those around them, that's in the past, you need to move on. So again, the message is being filtered down, don't talk about this. But my thought was, if this kid has finally got the courage to speak up, I wasn't saying that at 12 years old or 14 or 15. So if these young men were doing it and then they're being silenced, that this still goes on. Now, when I say that, I don't paint everyone with that same brush, but that is a huge piece of it, because I also worked in some institutional settings, again, for troubled kids. And every time they would bring up whatever, and it didn't have to be sexual abuse. Again, they were being told is you're mentally ill. That's all they kept hearing, because they're acting out. They had all these labels, and yet in their charts was the trauma and abuse that these kids were growing up with. So for me, I just keep speaking on it, writing about it, but also sharing, because there are organizations who are doing it right, there's agencies, there's people that are doing it right, but we have to be able to talk about this is still going on today.
Do you feel like it made a difference to have the involvement of a celebrity like Oprah Winfrey, for instance, in terms of raising awareness of this issue?
It definitely helps. It draws attention to it for a bit. But then, you know, and I understand she's got a career, she's got a show. They move on to the next thing. This is not the next thing. You know, not every, you know, and she's spoken about her abuse, but not everyone's going to rise to this level. And that's another thing with the trauma-informed. There's too much, you know, comparing. Well, if Oprah got through this or Tyler Perry, why aren't you getting it through it? Because you don't know the complexity of the trauma or the abuse that someone has had in their life. If they have had not any semblance of love in their life, they're going to be stuck and they're going to be spinning that wheel forever. But yes, to go back to the original question, it does help, but they need to sustain it. And they have the funds, the means, the power. They could help sustain it. And I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but I've, you know, it's like it's the flavor of the month. We'll do this. And I don't mean that in that way, but that's how it feels to us when we come forward and then, all right, where's the follow-up? Because, yeah.
It's a really good point, Mike. And it shows the, I think, the terrible seductiveness of celebrity. Like it seems like it's going to fix everything. It's almost like Oprah Winfrey jumping up and you get healing, except it doesn't quite always work out that way. And it's a long-term investment to address some of these issues. And I think that gets us back to this idea that we need to look at the institutions in our society that have been around for a long time, like schools, and figure out an effective way for them to contribute to identifying these kinds of concerns and issues.
One of the things also, and Jethro, when you were asking earlier about what can schools do, in most regions, I think nationally, there's always a sexual assault, domestic violence support center. A lot of them are doing things going into schools. And if they're not, maybe ask them. But I can think of a place that's out in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and they've done a lot of work for the past two decades going into schools just and how they raise awareness. But I also know what you were talking earlier. A lot of times they don't want them coming into schools. So there's different. So there are those that are out there that have that expertise to help with these things in the school system that, again, it's not incumbent upon the teachers, but reaching out to other agencies or organizations that are knowledgeable about these matters.
Well, and I think that the partnership piece is incredibly important. It is not just partnering with celebrities for, you know, attention, but partnering with other organizations within a community to provide full services to people who are struggling with this. And you said something a few minutes ago that I just thought was so powerful, that some of these 12 and 13 year old boys are actually sharing their story. And you mentioned earlier that it took you until you were about 40. Is that right? Before you started talking?
39 years old before I finally said it.
Yeah. And that is a long time to carry a burden that you can't share with anyone around you. And I know that there's somebody listening to this right now who's carrying that. What would be your advice to somebody who is carrying that to feel comfortable to say something to anyone? Because it can be so scary to talk to a trusted adult, a friend, or anybody else. What advice do you have for people in that situation?
If it's males, I would strongly suggest, looking at 1 in 6 organization. It's a nonprofit, just 1 in 6, one number and Male Survivor, two separate organizations. That's a great place for resources. RAIN, and my brain is stopping me, but RAIN for males and females. But there's several other really good nationwide agencies out there that they can reach out to, and they can be anonymous. They can go on anonymous and just, but even if they look at the effects of what the abuse has done to them, that might be the light bulb moment that they need, because I was just as guilty as so many others all through my life, thinking it to myself, wasn't saying it to anyone else, that, oh, that's in the past. I got to forget about this. And I did everything I could to forget about it. You can't forget about it because it's always with you. And then I finally had to deal with it. It hit me so hard. I had to. The flashbacks just became so overwhelming. You were talking earlier about the Polaroids. So it's not like I had repressed memory. I suppressed my memory. I did not want to deal with this, but I always had those Polaroid snapshots in my head. And then the age 39, it became a movie.
Mike, that's a brilliant metaphor.
It was a movie I didn't want to watch. I didn't. I'll be honest, I didn't. I was married. I had five kids. I had my own music business. I was still drumming on the weekends. Why do I want to look at this stuff? But it does impact, because I was also a workaholic. It kept me disconnected from others. I was always go, go, go. Now I can have a conversation with you guys. I can connect with other people. I can have a cup of coffee and sit there, or a cup of tea, or maybe a beer, and just sit there with someone, have a conversation, not be looking at my watch. Well, I got to go now. And then later on, I'm saying, I wish I'd stayed with them, but I never felt good about myself. So there is power in healing, and it's every one of us are going to find a different way there. But, and again, sometimes you don't have to share, but I just being with others, you know, my first support groups is going to adult children of alcoholics. You know, there was this camaraderie. We all had maybe different experiences, but it was impacting us. So childhood sexual abuse. So males, they're going to find their kindred spirits. They're going to find whether it's the CEO or the guy that's pounding nails, you know, building a house, or musician. It's all walks of life. It's impacted all of us. So I would start with those organizations.
I think it's really super impressive that we do see more and more organizations starting up or doing this work. You're a little bit older than I am, Mike, and I just think back to my childhood, and these organizations did not exist. You know, nobody was out here doing this stuff. And we'll put a bunch of stuff in the show notes, but it does seem appropriate to let everybody know that a place to start is the National Sexual Assault Hotline, which is 1-800-656-4673. And that does allow for anonymous reporting, conversation. It can be a place to start to get help if that's something someone needs.
Yeah. And in a lot of states, there's little support groups. I was born in Boston, but I lived in Massachusetts, then moved to New Hampshire. But I used to drive the hour and a half into Boston to attend a support group for survivors of those who've been abused, sexually abused as children. It was just worth it for me to have that camaraderie, even if I was just silent, even if I was just listening to other people, just that support and being validated again. As I shared earlier, we're disconnected. This was helping me to reconnect with people.
Well, and that's a piece that is so important in a place like a school, a church, and any place that can provide that connection is going to be important. And it's even worse, as you were saying, that this happened in a church, in a place that should be providing appropriate connection, and it doesn't. And so, you know, there's definitely a lot of work to do. And I don't think that this problem is ever going to go away. There's going to be evil people all the time. And we need to do our best to prevent kids from being exposed to that. And when we know about it, then getting them out of those situations as a priority.
I agree. But fortunately, the evil people, the minority, there's more good people in the world. So I always, you know, I'll share about, you know, what's wrong, but there's also so much that is good, because I truly believe there is hope, there is healing, and there is help out there. So I will speak to the stuff that's not working, but I also see the good. Even with myself, I don't get a million clicks on my website anymore. But when I first came out, I was maybe one of maybe 100 males out there doing, so that was huge. that I think would help get that initial interest in me and also addressing the mental health, the depression as a male. Now the landscape, there are hundreds of males and females out there now talking, more so with the males who have found, there's a lot who have, they have stepped forward and they've created their own podcasts. They're writing books. They've got blogs. They're just, or they got a Facebook group, or they're just speaking out. And so that's where I do see we're breaking down those silos of silence.
Well, it's interesting, Mike, because I think what you're doing is pointing to the dichotomy that we talk a lot about on this show, that technology does prevent or does present some additional risks, right? Your particular circumstance arose within the home. For teachers who cross that particular boundary, you know, their path to doing so is facilitated by smartphones and cell phones and all the rest of it. But at the same time, there's tremendous potential for building community using these cyber tools. I've seen it time and time again in terms of people creating the kinds of groups that you're talking about, or using their voice or using their blog, partly in self-therapy, but also partly in education and advocacy, like you yourself are doing.
Yeah, because myself as an independent musician, I could have never had this reach a couple decades ago if it wasn't for the internet. So I am grateful for the good that it brings, that I can reach a lot more people than I could have just trying to tour New England.
Yeah, I would love it if you'd be comfortable playing us out with a song. I mean, we're pretty much at the end of the podcast. Are you willing to do that?
And as a fellow Bostonian, I was going to be pushy enough to ask that myself.
So you're a Bostonian too. All right, cool.
1963, Richardson House. Yep.
Okay. I always say when I'm going back to Boston and Cambridge, that's where I lived, I go, I'm returning to the scenes of the crimes. But I also like it.
Everybody says that about Boston.
Yeah. All right. So this is Songs for the Keys to Your Life.
Your fingers to the bone, the grinds, and it's all that you see. Once made of gold, nothing so cold, and so forgotten your dreams. Even though, even care, when did you drop the keys? Keys, your dreams, and music to your soul. Songs to the keys delight. Songs to the keys delight. Have you sung the song for the keys delight? Wasted away, and what then to say of all the things that you love? All I see is broken inside love. Now the dreaming, the fleshing schemes climb your way to the top. Look around and what do you see? Wasteland of all that you loved. Songs of the keys delight. Songs of the keys delight. Songs of the keys delight. Have you sung the song of the keys delight?
Thank you. That was great.
Thank you.
That was wonderful, Mike. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Well, thank you for having me. And thank you for asking me.
Oh, well, it was a wise and inspired request. It's come off really well. And I appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Yeah. And I've got links to the things that we talked about in the show notes that people can find on the website. And just thank you so much for being here, Mike. Your story is really inspiring of how you're able to overcome. And we appreciate you sharing that.
Well, thanks again, guys, for what you do. And thanks for having me again, Truana. Oh, Fred Burlington, did you go to Texas or the New England Club New England?
Club New England, yes.
Okay, because I used to play in those places. Then I booked bands in those places.
Well, who was it? Nestor, you remember Nestor? He ran a restaurant up there, and he also did booking bands and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and great guy.
Yeah, Hans Jenny was also up there.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fun city. I was there for 23 years, and of course, now I'm in Brooklyn, so what's the difference, right? Anyway, folks, that wraps up this episode of the Cybertraps podcast. In the coming weeks, we'll continue our coverage of emerging trends in a variety of areas, including digital misconduct, cyber safety, cybersecurity, privacy, and the challenges of high-tech parenting. Along the way, we'll talk to our growing collection of international experts and artists who are helping us to understand the risks and the rewards of digital technology.
You can find the Cybertraps podcast on all your favorite podcast apps. We hope that you've enjoyed the show and will share it with your friends and colleagues. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, I'm at Jethro Jones, Fred is at Cybertraps, and Mike is at Michael Skin E at the end, 1-1. And there's a link to that in the show notes. If you're still listening, you must have loved this podcast. And if that's the case, please leave us a 5-star rating and review in your podcast player of choice. We appreciate having you with us and look forward to seeing you on our next live episode on Monday.
Do you want to save time on prep work, increase student achievement for all of your students, reliably meet Tier 1 standards? You can do it all, but don't waste another minute. Head straight to IXL.com/B to learn how IXL's research-proven teaching and learning platform can help you achieve these goals. That's IXL.com/BE.